This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. I'm glad to have your company on this Sunday. The global refugee crisis is truly a worldwide issue, affecting not just refugees from Syria and the Middle East, Asia, Africa, and elsewhere. The countries around the world struggling to deal with whether and how to accept and integrate them. The United States has accepted a smaller number of refugees in recent years than some European countries. And yet, right here in Virginia, people from other countries fleeing violence and persecution are finding a home. And although some politicians raise fears of terrorism or other specters to sound the alarm, many of our fellow citizens are welcoming those refugees and helping them make a new life here. We'll revisit some of those excellent stories from our Refugees series, first heard earlier this year right here on WMRA. Stay tuned for that. But first, during this American election year, NPR has been exploring how people in other countries view the United States. WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini gets the reaction of French immigrants to the U.S., in particular, how they feel about a distinctly different approach the two countries take to work life and vacation time.
The European lifestyle, in particular that of the French, is often somewhat of a joke in the U.S., where work ethics seem to be different. An Ipsos Global and Reuters study found a few years ago that only 57% of Americans use their vacation days. That makes them the fifth most workaholic country on Earth. Meanwhile, that study showed French citizens leading the way in taking advantage of their vacations, with 89% taking all of their allotted time. I meet with Charlottesville French teacher Pascal Habgood at Seville Coffee. She arrived in the U.S. almost 30 years ago and is a lecturer at the University of Virginia. She also teaches at a foreign and English language center and at a French educational association promoting French language and culture. From what Pascal tells me, her perspective aligns completely with the study's results.
This is much more serious here. People are dedicated to their job, at least in the kind of jobs that I've had and where I've worked. Nowadays, with the technology we have, I see my husband constantly answering emails on vacation. We go away at the beach. He's supposed to be completely off. But he says, I have to take this. I have to answer this. In my mind, it's too much.
And the French government seems to agree. In April, the National Assembly passed a so-called Right to Disconnect law, effective this coming January. The law will give workers the right to ignore emails and will protect them from bosses that would punish them for not answering work emails in hours they're not supposed to be working. Patrick Jones, a host of the travel and lifestyle newsfeed website Buzz60, explains what is at stake.
They want to keep work at work. The new law would give employees the right to ignore calls, texts, emails from bosses on nights and weekends so they can go socialize. I know a lot of you, being American capitalists, are freaking out now, saying, oh, the French are lazy. But let this information actually sink in. You would not get in trouble for ignoring emails. It doesn't take more than 2 seconds to search Google to find that our constant state of connectedness is killing us. Maybe it's a little lofty or unrealistic, but isn't that what society should be trying to head towards?
But Pascal does not think the French model is perfect either. And it may not work in America, where the entrepreneurial spirit is deeply ingrained in the nation's history.
Because in France, it's not serious enough. People couldn't care less what happens to the business. They don't think past their nose and, think, oh, my little vacation, but don't think of the good of the company in the end.
For another French view, I checked in with pastry chef Serge Torres at a Charlottesville French restaurant.
I've been in America since June 1993, so I started to work in New York with my cousin Jacques Torres in New York.
This would be the beginning of a long career taking him through many restaurants throughout the country and throughout the world. And what did it take from his varied experience in the U.S. compared to France?
In America, we have more flexibility, and the comparison between America and France, it gives me more opportunity to work for different companies. They kind of give you the chance to try to show what you can do, more than try to look at your resume. This is what I like about America, the opportunity of and diversity of work.
And what about France's 35-hour work week policy? That may not be as different from the American dedication to work as you think. According to Fortune, French rules aren't really that much different from those in place in the U.S. The French actually can work more than that, and they tend to work closer to 40 hours per week, just like Americans do. The main difference is French society tends to compensate in leisure time rather than in cash. The main difference in working hours and income between France and the US boils down to the fact that French law mandates 5 weeks of vacation. Quite a culture shock for French people here. For WMRA News, I am Marguerite Gallerini.
Now, to some of the more compelling stories from WMRA's Refugees in Virginia series, and we'll start with a report by Jesse Nadler from an environment that's difficult enough, let alone if you're in a strange country. I'm talking, of course, about high school. Even if those were great years for you, there were certainly times when you felt a little lost or left out. Well, imagine going to high school in another country with another language and another culture. Oh, and you may also be carrying trauma from some horrific things you witnessed in your home country. Here's Jesse's story of a Harrisonburg High School program that pairs refugee students with others who have been there.
Guess what is the second most common foreign language behind Spanish spoken at Harrisonburg City Schools? Give up? It's Arabic. 11% of students come from Arab-speaking homes. Harrisonburg's school system is really where you see the city's status as an immigration hub come to life. More than one out of every three students are identified as limited English speakers. Within that population, kids come from 47 different countries with more than 48 languages spoken. Behind the U.S., the majority of students are born in Iraq and Honduras. High school is already kind of a nightmare. Peer pressure, academic pressure, identity issues, body image issues. Now add to that the stress, the language barriers, the trauma of being a refugee from a war-torn country, and you get an idea of how difficult it can be to navigate high school.
Since I was a kid, there was war there in Baghdad. It was like really big war.
This is Ali. He's 19 and from Iraq. Ali's father was granted asylum to come to the United States, but he had to leave his family behind. Ali says he was shot at when it was discovered his father had gone to the U.S.
We was sleeping and wake up with bombs and shooting and people get killed every day.
Ali hadn't seen his father for 5 years until Ali and his brother were finally able to join him in Harrisonburg a year and a half ago. His father, who was a teacher in Baghdad, now works at a turkey processing facility.
Yeah, I miss my country like so much. I had friends, I had family. I was there for 18 years. And you cannot leave your country and forget about it.
Laura Feistinger McGrath takes me into an office and flips through a stack of files of new students to the high school.
This one is from, he's a refugee from Ecuador. She is from El Salvador. She is from Honduras. She is from Mexico. He is from Iraq. He's a returning student from New York.
She's the ESL, that's English as Second Language, coordinator for all Harrisonburg City Schools. Her title is a bit of an understatement, because although she's tasked with making sure kids enrolled in the ESL program, which represents some 10% of the total school population of 1,400, are taught English, some of these kids are dealing with incredibly complex issues. It's what makes her job both rewarding and challenging.
We have students who are joining family for the first time in 10, 15, some of them 17 years. We have students who have seen their friends, family, executed, killed, bombed, all sorts of things. And some who've had really traumatic journeys actually into the United States. There's a lot of feelings of abandonment from some of our students. Some of our students have experienced sexual violence.
A lot of immigrant kids end up taking on very adult responsibilities.
I have students who are as young as 11 and 12 who have helped their parents with mortgages. Like, I have no idea how these kids are negotiating that, which is interesting because then we throw them a multiple choice test and say that they're not successful. But the reality is they're negotiating real life, meaningful experiences.
To help refugee students integrate into the high school, a pilot program called Peer Leaders was launched last year using funding from the Harrisonburg Refugee Resettlement Office. It's a mentoring program in which new students are paired with students who were themselves refugees. Peer leaders are given 3 days of training in basic counseling, how to be an active listener, how to ask questions, and crucially, when to refer a problem to an adult.
We don't want kids to carry adult burdens on their backs.
When I came here, I was really scared. I didn't know what to do. I don't know the language. I don't know anyone.
One day, a Kurdish girl approached Ali in the hallway and asked him in Arabic if he was all right. It was a small gesture that meant a lot, to know that someone from his culture was looking out for him. He joined peer leaders so he could repeat this kindness to incoming Arab students.
There's a couple when they came here. I took them to classes. I told them some of the rules. I told them if they need help with the teacher, with the counselor, with anything, I'm here to help.
The peer leader program has been successful on an ad hoc basis. These are teenagers. It can be difficult to get them to commit to a mentorship program on top of everything else they're dealing with.
They don't know how to articulate all the time what their issues are. And then they don't always realize, adults don't always realize the extreme issues that might be happening in a high school, especially a high school like ours.
It's easy to assume that the stream of refugees at Harrisonburg High is the result of the current global migration crisis. But the demographics have been like this for 15 years. The countries of strife may have changed, Bosnia and Russia to Iraq and Honduras today, but the human beings seeking refuge do not. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
People who come here seeking asylum from violence in other countries often suffer from years of poor or even non-existent medical care. In this story, WMRA's Jordi Yeager introduced us to one such patient and the doctors at the University of Virginia who focus on the special needs of asylum seekers.
Still, I'm alive because of the help and the generosity of the American people and the American government. Otherwise, I would have died had I not come here.
56-year-old Bimal Chetri isn't exaggerating. In all likelihood, he really would be dead if he hadn't come to Charlottesville as a refugee 2 years ago.
I came here as a kidney patient, right? So they had already fixed everything for me, for my treatment in the UVA. So from the first month only, I've been under the doctor's supervision and under treatment. So it has been more than two years. I've been getting the best of the treatment, and I'm still alive. I have only 11% kidneys working.
Chetri was born in Bhutan and spent 20 years living in a refugee camp in Nepal. Today, he sits comfortably in the living room of his ground floor apartment. His wife cooks a potato dish for us in the adjacent kitchen. His granddaughter watches cartoons on the couch. Every 8 hours, he gets dialysis for kidney failure that resulted from untreated high blood pressure. He doesn't own a car, so once a month he walks the 3-mile round trip to the University of Virginia Hospital for a checkup. Chetri is one of more than 3,000 refugees who've moved to Charlottesville through the International Rescue Committee since 1998. When they arrive, the IRC directs refugees to the health department, where they get rescreened and receive the vaccinations required by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They're enrolled in Medicaid and referred to UVA for their health needs.
I'm Fern Houck. I'm a physician at the University of Virginia in the Department of Family Medicine.
When Dr. Houck moved here 15 years ago, refugees had to bounce all over UVA and sometimes all over town to get the care they needed. Imagine doing that in a foreign country where you don't speak or read the language. When Dr. Houck saw this, she collaborated with the IRC and the health department and created the International Family Medicine Clinic at UVA.
Basically, we agreed that we would be the primary care physicians for all the refugees who come through the IRC into Charlottesville. The thing that's unique about our program is that we don't have a separate refugee clinic. It's incorporated into our family medicine clinic at the primary care center here.
Now, this may seem trivial, but by incorporating refugees into the everyday American experience of going to see a doctor, one significant border in a country filled with linguistic, social, and cultural barriers is crossed. The International Family Medicine Clinic has more than 2,000 refugee patients. At their initial visit, Houck and her colleagues use an in-person interpreter to explain what a family physician is. Then they try to create a medical history for the patient. Some refugees, like those from Iraq and Syria, have lived in cities and had access to relatively good medical services, while others, like the Burmese and Bhutanese, have lived in refugee camps for decades where chronic diseases such as hypertension, diabetes, and high cholesterol have likely gone undiagnosed and untreated. Doctors do hearing and vision tests, nutritional assessments. If need be, they refer refugees to a specialist or a local dentist for tooth decay, which is a huge problem. But treatment and diagnosis are a fraction of what Houck and her colleagues do.
I'd say we spend 75% plus of our time doing education. Think about the United States perhaps 30 years ago and think about where people were thinking about high blood pressure, for instance. So we really are starting from square one on so many fronts. We're explaining a lot of disorders and diseases to them. We're explaining why we need to treat them with medicine and what happens if we don't treat them with medicine.
In many ways, patients with physical aches and pains are the easiest to care for. How do you explain ailments that patients have yet to feel? Things like heart disease or preventative treatments like mammograms and colonoscopies. Even more difficult are the unseen injuries some refugees have sustained.
We've also worked very hard on the mental health side. Mental health is a huge, huge, huge issue. We've talked about people coming from war-torn areas, being displaced from their homes, seeing people killed in front of their very eyes. Sorry.
Dr. Hauck chokes up when she thinks about the trauma some of her patients have suffered. Some female refugees have been raped or been victims of genital mutilation. Others have been physically tortured. There's no easy way to raise such traumatic and horrific events, but from a medical perspective, they need to. Studies show that depression and post-traumatic stress disorder are more common among refugees than average Americans, and if left untreated, can lead to suicide. And that's where Dr. Claudia Allen comes in.
A lot of refugees, if not all, have experienced some kind of trauma.
Allen is the director of behavioral services and family medicine at UVA and a clinical psychologist at the hospital's family stress clinic, where Hauck refers refugees with mental health needs.
A lot of people do find themselves experiencing symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Not only do mental health issues manifest as physical ailments like head or stomach aches, they also severely affect day-to-day life. Whether you're a child trying to concentrate in school or an adult trying to adapt to a new job, often refugees will experience something called hypervigilance.
You know, their brain might tell them, no, it's okay now. I'm here in Charlottesville. There's not a war going on. You know, I'm actually safe. But the other part of your brain and your kind of reactions are still very heightened. And so they might be easily startled by loud noises, or they might feel anxious around strangers.
Because gaining the trust of their patients is imperative to the mental health process, Allen aims to provide care frequently, a little at a time, over a long time. While providing refugees with physical and mental health care is challenging, both Dr. Allen and Dr. Hauck repeatedly stress that the benefits make their job enormously gratifying. They speak of the unparalleled resilience and strength they see in their refugee patients and their fortified work ethic and perseverance. Hauck's been invited to refugee weddings and adopted as an honorary family member. But perhaps the greatest joy is the prospect of seeing former patients return, not as patients, but as practitioners.
And that's been an incredibly rewarding piece, especially to see children who I've taken care of when they were 6 or 7 or 8 or 9, and now they're graduating from the University of Virginia. I have one who I just heard about from her mom that she just graduated this past year from dental school in Richmond. So that's pretty incredible. I want them to come back here and practice.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
And finally, for refugees trying to establish themselves in a strange land, just like for the rest of us, reliable transportation can be the key to landing a job or simply being independent. One Harrisonburg bicycling enthusiast is not only teaching refugees how to ride bikes, she's also providing them with their own bicycles. WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz attended a recent class this summer and had this report.
The morning is not without incident. A crowd of about 10 volunteers and even more refugees from all over the world, Cuba, Pakistan, Congo, are gathered in a church parking lot to learn some tips for riding bicycle in America.
So use your back brake a little more and you'll skid rather than flipping.
There you go.
The best part? At the end of the 2 hours, the bikes they're using during the lesson will be theirs to keep. Last fall, Harrisonburg resident Richie Vaughn met with a group of women from Iraq to garner feedback about the city's bus system, sidewalks, and related infrastructure.
So just sort of offhand, I said, well, do any of you ride a bike? Because I can get across town in 20 minutes on a bike, and you're saying it takes an hour on a bus. And a bunch of them kind of like, you know, giggled and put their heads down. And it turns out that in Iraq, it's actually not socially, culturally acceptable to ride a bike if you're a woman. And several of them expressed interest in learning how to ride a bike, sort of for self-empowerment and this sort of new thing that you can do in America.
Vaughn's first class was geared toward that handful of women and some children. Her second was for 4 men from Eritrea who already knew how to ride, but needed to learn the rules of the road here, and who needed bikes. One of the 15 bicycle recipients at this recent class is Fareed Ahmed, a college computer lecturer from Karachi City in Pakistan, where he faced religious persecution. Just 2 months ago, after 3 years in Sri Lanka, he arrived in the United States. He's looking for work and says that not having a job leaves him bored at home.
Now I have bicycle, so I will use it. So it's very helpful for me to travel, especially to little nearest places. Like I want to go market or some store, or maybe I can go job through this cycle. Because some places I search, bus cannot reach there. That's why it will very helpful for me.
The first part of the class is fitting helmets, here with volunteer Phoebe Kirby-Gletkowski.
Too tight now? Sorry, okay, we can make it looser.
Four of the bikes were paid for by the voluntary gas tax campaign in Harrisonburg, purchased new, and at cost, from Wise Cycles. Another was donated by the Bridgewater Rotary Club. Otherwise, says Vaughn,
I've pretty much bankrolled the program thus far.
Out on the parking lot pavement, Vaughn introduces the instructor for the day, Matt Hassman of Safe Routes to School.
Matt is going to teach us basic laws and rules here, and then we will go practice in the street with cars.
This drill will be to practice stopping quickly. Practice using both brakes so you don't go forward over the bars when you stop.
After the lesson, everyone divides into smaller language-specific clusters with an instructor and interpreter for each group, and they ride out onto the streets through a residential area of town. Carl Goetz is volunteering with a Spanish-speaking group.
Don't ride too close to parked cars because somebody can open a door.
The bicycle Ahmed receives isn't one of the brand new ones and is without a hoped-for rack for carrying supplies. Nonetheless, he is pleased that he again has his own bicycle.
I had my bicycle in Sri Lanka, so I donate to some other refugees. They can use it. I donate there and God arranged for me here. So I am happy.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Eugene Stoltz, Swiss Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, and an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. You'll find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org, and be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio. Follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. And as we head into the final week of our fall More News, Less Noise Fund Drive, please don't forget to give at WMRA.org. We're shooting to hit $100,000 by tonight. Our fundraiser ends next Monday, October the 3rd. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. I'll talk to you in the morning.